Hello and welcome to the TAA Audio Conference, How to Be a Successful Freelance Writer for College Textbook Publishers, presented by John Soriz, who has worked as a freelance writer of college textbook supplements since 1994. He has created over 200 supplements and ancillaries for major higher education publishers, including Cengage, Pearson Education, and McGraw-Hill, in fields ranging from political science and history to geography, earth science, and biology. He holds a BS in biochemistry and a master's in political science from the University of California, Davis. He is the author of Writing College Textbook Supplements, The Definitive Guide to Winning High-Paying Assignments in the College Textbook Publishing Market, and he writes the Writing College Textbook Supplements blog and the Productive Freelance Writers blog. John is an avid hiker in Northern California, and especially loves the mountains around the Mount Shasta area where he makes his home with his partner, Stephanie. He shares his love of hiking on his hiking blog. I now turn the session over to John.
Well, thank you very much, Kim, and thanks to everybody listening to this call. I appreciate your time, and I know your time is valuable, and I'm really glad to be able to share what I do with you. And just a little bit, you're wherever you are right now. I'm just going to tell you where I am. I'm in my home in the Shasta Valley, which is a rural area on the north side of Mount Shasta in the rain shadow of Mount Shasta. And I'm looking out my office window first at a bird feeder. It's about 4 or 5 feet from my head. That's getting a lot of activity this morning. And then beyond that, I see ponderosa pines and western junipers. So let's talk about what we're going to be doing today. Let me give you an overview. You should have a handout that Kim sent to you, and that lays out what we'll be doing today. For starters, I'm going to start discussing my background in academics and as a writer. Then I'll move on to how I got started being a freelance writer for college textbook publishers. Then I'll move on to discuss details of how to be a successful freelance writer in this field. Finally, I'll take questions from you, and I request that you wait until the end of the talk to ask me your questions. I truly do welcome them, and I'm looking forward to them, but it would be better for me if they all came at the end. Okay, my background, Kim just told you some of it. But let's look a bit at my academic background. I have an AS degree in engineering from Shasta College in Reading, which means I took a lot of physics and calculus courses and chemistry and statics and courses like that. I then moved on to UC Davis, where I got a BS degree in biochemistry. I did research at UC Davis in Professor Marilyn Etzler's lab in the early 1980s. And after that, I was fortunate to get a job doing research at the biochemistry department at the University of Lund in southern Sweden. And from there, I moved on and moved to Ithaca, New York, where I was a research assistant for about a year and a half at the pharmacology department at Cornell. From there, I eventually went back to UC Davis to pursue a master's degree in political science. I then taught part-time for several years at Butte College in Northern California, just outside of Chico, and also a bit at Shasta College, which is in Redding, just a bit further north. During the course of my studies, I've always had a broad interest in many, many subjects. Physical sciences, life sciences, and social sciences have always fascinated me. So I took coursework in many areas, including geography and earth sciences and other subject areas. Regarding outdoors writing, that was my first foray into becoming a professional writer. I started doing that right around 1990. I've written 3 hiking guidebooks on Northern California, all published by the Mountaineers Books, which is a major trade outdoors publisher up in Seattle. I've also written over 100 magazine and newspaper articles. And if any of you are interested in that, I have a website where I write frequently about hiking-related matters in Northern California. To get to that, you can go to calhike.com, C-A-L-H-I-K-E.com, and it will forward you through to the main site. All right, let's move on to number 2 on the list of of the outline here and discuss how I got started writing textbook supplements. Well, I was teaching political science courses at Butte College in Chico. I was teaching American government, international relations, and politics of developing nations. I had already started my outdoors writing career, and I was interested in pursuing writing. I was also interested in getting a full-time teaching position, but those were rare and difficult to come by, so I knew I couldn't count on that, so I was looking for another good way to supplement my income. And I met the book representatives that would come around, and I'm sure those of you who teach are very aware of them. They're coming around trying to convince you to adopt their textbook. So I talked to one of these book reps, and I said, hey, who writes these test banks and these instructor's manuals and all these other things that you give us when we adopt your textbook? And she said, well, people like you do that. And so she gave me the contact of the editor in political science. I sent that editor a cover letter and my resume through the mail. This was back before email. This was early 1990s. And I got my first project for HarperCollins. It was an American government test bank for a brand new book. And it was 1,600 questions, multiple choice, true, false, short answer, and essay. And I remember I got $4,000. And I did that over the summer of 1992. And I thought, wow, this is interesting and fun and pretty easy. So I began contacting more editors in from other companies, and then eventually they began contacting me to do projects. So that's how I got started. And for the first couple of years, I did it part-time while I continued to teach, but eventually I realized that I was starting to make enough money from doing the supplements, and I was also starting to make a little bit of money from book royalties and also getting some money from the magazine and newspaper articles I was writing on the outdoors, that I decided to become a freelance writer and to leave teaching. And I did love teaching. I loved it very, very much. But I did what I thought was best for me, for my freedom, and basically my bottom line. All right. Number three on our list, what I enjoy most about being a freelance writer. There's several things. I really enjoy using my brain. I just love thinking about things, analyzing things. I also really like to learn. And, of course, when I'm working on a textbook supplement, I know most of the material there, but there's always things I don't know. There's new examples, and then it's reinforcing what I already know, and then it's remembering some of the things I forgot, and I appreciate that. And so learning and using my brain is important. I also like being able to set my own schedule, and this is something that you'll hear many freelancers say. They say, oh, yeah, I'm in my pajamas, all that sort of stuff, sitting in my computer. Well, there's truth to that. I'm at home, and I get to do what I want when I want, and I very much appreciate that. There's times I definitely have to work very, very hard, so it's not always this, oh, I worked 2 or 3 hours and I took the rest of the day off, although that does happen from time to time. And as an example, there was one period a few years ago where I actually worked 53 days in a row. And those of you that have been in graduate school, you may say, okay, well, yeah, I've done that before too, but I was out of graduate school. And anyway, I did that. I made it through that. I did take several afternoons off. There were definitely some days I worked till noon and then just take the rest of the day off. But so it's not always just super easy and light. But unrelated aspect of setting my own schedule, since I don't have to be at somebody's place of business or at a university to do my work, I'm able to live wherever I want. And that is pretty much what I've done. And just some examples of the most interesting and beautiful places I've lived since I left teaching Butte College in 1994. I lived on the island of Kauai in Hawaii from 1996 through 1999, and that was all because I was able to take my work with me. And then after I left Kauai, I wound up buying a house on the north coast of California near the border with Oregon, and I lived there for several years. And then since 2005, I've lived in the Mount Shasta area. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the geography of far northern California, Mount Shasta is a 14,179-foot high volcano at the southern end of the Cascade Range. It's incredibly beautiful, and there's lots of mountains and lakes around here, and it's quite rural. The largest town in our very large Siskiyou County has about 7,500 people. And I live, as I said earlier, on the north side of Mount Shasta in the rural Shasta Valley. So other good things about being a freelance writer, I get to live where I want, and I've also been able to travel frequently. I do like to be other places besides Mount Shasta, and I like to do a lot of house sitting with my partner Stephanie. And just recently in October, I spent 3 weeks house sitting in a very nice home in the Bernal Heights area in San Francisco. And later this week, I'm going to be leaving to spend several weeks in the Santa Cruz area, all house sitting for free, and usually have to take care of somebody's wonderful dog, but that's it. And also, when there are slow times in my freelance writing schedule, and that definitely does happen from time to time, I'll take the time and go backpacking or work on my other freelance writing projects. So let's move on to our next topic here. How to find supplements editors. We're getting into the meat of how you actually do this and get the jobs and make the money. Well, there are four main ways to find supplements editors. Number one is through sales representatives, the book reps that I talked about earlier. If you are teaching, you'll see these people walking around the halls. Now, some of you may be trying to avoid the book reps, but go out of your way and say, hi, are you a book rep? And tell them what you want to do and what you're interested in, and I think you'll find that they are interested in helping you to connect with editors in their companies. The second way to do it is to find specific editors for your discipline at the publisher's website. And each website is a bit different, but if you go to the website, you will find, you can certainly find how to find sales representatives there. Some websites will direct you to specific editors and specific disciplines where you can connect with people. Some don't make it so easy. Some will have email addresses of editors and names. Some may even have phone numbers. So that's the second way to find them. Number three is to ask other freelance writers who are also writing supplements and ancillaries for college textbooks. I have personally helped several people get into contact with editors and companies, and these people have gone on to get projects and get work. So you can definitely do that, too. It's a great way to network. And finally, number four, ask editors you already work with to help you connect with other editors that are either in the same discipline or in a related discipline or another discipline that you want to work in. I have found that if you are working, let's say you're working on a print supplement, let's say you're working on a test bank for a textbook, there's the print supplements, but sometimes there's a different editor that handles what the online materials are, like a student companion site. So you may be able to get patched through to that other editor and get projects that way. So you get multiple things going on. And this leads me to an important point to think about here. And it's jumping ahead a little bit, but I want to make sure you get this. And that is, it's very helpful to work on multiple projects for the same textbook at the same time. You will find that you get a good synergy with your time because you have to read all the material in the textbook, and let's say you're updating things from one edition to the next, which is the most common type of situation you'll find. You have to look at the new material, and usually you also have to look at the old textbook. You can look at that once and then apply what you know to multiple supplements, and you get a better return on your time for that. So anyway, going back to asking editors to connect you with other editors, this has really been very important for me expanding my career such that I make a solid middle-class income doing this. I was able to get more and more projects by going laterally within the same company. For example, Cengage political science editors connected me with Cengage history editors. This was back when they were Wadsworth before they got bought up by a private company that turned it into Cengage. And then eventually that led to me doing environmental science work for Cengage with their Brooks Cole imprint. So those are the four main ways to find supplements editors. All right, moving on to the next topic, number five, how to win assignments. Let's look at five different things you need to do to win an assignment. For starters, you have to choose your subject areas. Some of you, this may just be one area. For me, I have several areas, and the more areas you have, the more likely it is that you're going to be able to get enough work, to get all the work you want. It helps to have a diverse educational background like I do. I have knowledge in a lot of different subject areas. But anyway, you need to choose your subject areas. Then number two, you need to prepare your CV or resume, and most of you already have that, but you need to have that and spiff it up. Then number three, make a list of skills and accomplishments that are relevant to writing textbook supplements. This would include things like publications that you have, but also skills like what software can you use? Are you familiar with Microsoft Office, with Word, Excel, PowerPoint? Because that comes up frequently, especially Word and PowerPoint. There's other software that you're comfortable with. List that also. Then number four, you want to collect writing samples that you will be prepared to send to editors upon request. And these can include things that you've already created. For example, you've been teaching, so you may have questions for tests that you've written. And that's how I got started for my initial assignment, is I had to create all of my own tests for my Politics of Developing Nations course because there just really wasn't anything else out there. I had a hard time even finding a suitable textbook. So I was able to say, here's all these tests that I've written, multiple choice and true, false, and essay questions that I've written, and that really helped me. So showing your own questions is really important. If there are any exercises you've created for your students, like you ask them to go online and research a certain subject and then answer specific questions for you, use those. If you've given out term paper topics where you write about that and what you want them to do, use those. If you have lecture outlines that you've created, typically this is in PowerPoint, you can include one or two chapters of that. And finally, if you are already a published supplements author, you can include samples of what you've already published. Usually I would just include a chapter or so and make sure you identify it and say this came from such and such. And then there may be other things that you could think of that you would want to include. And then finally, number five, you can either call the editor or email the editor. And different people have different styles with that. I personally typically like to go for a phone call so I can develop a good rapport with somebody on the phone. Other people are more comfortable emailing the editor. And, of course, it may depend. You may only have a phone number or only have an email address, and that may determine right there how you're going to make the initial contact. If you do call an editor on the phone, give a brief introduction, say who you are and what you want, and ask if they have a couple of minutes of time to discuss potential projects. Many people are really, really busy, and if you call somebody at the wrong time, when they have a meeting in a minute or two, they're not going to be able to deal with you adequately. And just by saying, do you have 2 minutes to do this, they can say, well, you know, I really don't. Can you call me back at? And then you want to talk to them at a time when they are feeling comfortable and relaxed and ready to fully engage with you. And an important point to think about here, when you are getting assignments, is remember what editors want. Editors want reliable freelance writers that will write great supplements for them and will finish those supplements on time with no hassles. That's what they want. And if you can assure them that that is what you will do, you're very likely to get hired. All right, number six, the earning potential. let's talk about pay rates. On my blog, my website, writingcollegetextbooksupplements.com, I talk about how I make $50 an hour or more on my projects. And that's true. I do make $50 an hour or more on my projects. There are some projects I've made $100 an hour and sometimes even a little more than that. I am fast and I am experienced. And I also occasionally turn down projects that are low pay. And I've seen some very low paying projects. Sometimes there will just be a very small budget for a project. And the pay rate, if you were to estimate how long it would take you and figure out how much the money is, sometimes it's as low as $10 an hour. I once had one editor, this was a long time ago, this was probably 1996 or 1997, wanted an instructor's manual created for a brand new textbook that was a large textbook, and this included test questions and everything, and he said, I can only pay $750, and that would be below minimum wage. So it just varies depending on the project and the publisher. And there are other factors, of course, that determine that $50 an hour, and I'm going to discuss that a little later, and that is just how efficiently can you get this done? How quickly can you get the work done? But I'll talk about that a little later. Now, something else about earning potential, and that is the work chunks at certain times of the year. So you can't assume that you're going to average, I'll make $3,000 or $4,000 a month doing this every month. It may not be that way. It could be that you make a bunch of money in a couple of months, and then you have 2 months where there is none of this work. And I've been in a situation since the beginning of October where I've had a lot of work, a ton of work. I'm going to make enough money in the last 3 months of the year to support me for just about an entire year. Of course, I've been pretty busy, but I've still had enough free time to stay happy. Now, during those times that you have free time, you've got that time to do other writing projects, and I know that a lot of people listening today are teachers or have other work. So if you're a college instructor, you may only want to do 3 or 4 of these a year, enough where it's not a major burden on you with your teaching load. But just be aware that it's not something that is going to be steady throughout the year. And, of course, it takes time to create a client base and get known and develop expertise so you start getting offered more assignments. And one other point here. If you are, like me, somebody who is willing to do this work full-time, let editors know that because most of them are used to working with college professors, people that have a teaching schedule and don't have the time to do 30, 40, 50 hours a week of work on supplements. So you really have to, you may have to tell them multiple times because sometimes they just think, I can offer you one project, and they may have 5 projects, but they just don't think to offer you all 5. So if you want more, just keep asking, what else do you have? I do this full time. I meet my deadlines. I'll get it done. Number 7, should a supplements writer have a website? Well, if you've looked at the handout that Ken sent with the most recent email announcing this, you'll see that I actually have several websites. My main supplements website, as I already mentioned, is writingcollegetextbooksupplements.com. That has been very important for me as far as getting work. For example, in 2010, this is for editors that found me by doing Google searches. They needed writers, and they did a Google search, and they found my website and contacted me. I got about roughly $12,000 worth of work in 2010 just from people finding me through my website. And I turned down another several thousand dollars worth of work from one editor because when he approached me, I was already too busy to take that work. So should you have a website? I would say yes if writing supplements and ancillaries is an important part of your income stream. If you're a full-time college instructor and you just want to do 1 or 2 of these a year to make maybe an extra $5,000 or $10,000 or something, then I would say no, don't bother with a website. But if this is something you really want to pursue as an important income stream, I would say yes, you should have a website. Now, there are I don't want to go into a lot of detail about this because some of you either already know a lot about this, most of you probably don't, but there's two main ways to build websites that people are doing now. One is a static HTML site, which is like sites that you saw 5 years ago. And those are the kind where they don't really change much. They're just there, and you need to have some experience with a web design software like Dreamweaver to go in and change things, which a lot of people don't have that experience. So there's that, static HTML. And then there are WordPress sites. If you look at my sites, those are all WordPress blogs, and you can do anything you want to build a website with WordPress. It's great, and I love it. But I would not use WordPress unless you plan to blog and plan to blog frequently and think about that, because you may think you want to do it and then you do it once or twice and you go, I'm tired of this. But only use WordPress if you want to make a lot of changes and you want to blog. Otherwise, go with a static page. The main reason is that WordPress is vulnerable to hacking and getting infected with viruses and spyware, and it takes some upkeep to prevent that, and there's just some vulnerabilities. There's times it can just happen to you. It happened to me last May multiple times when I was hosting on GoDaddy. I since switched from them to HostGator, but you don't want that to happen to you, whereas if you have a static HTML page, it's highly unlikely anything will happen, and it can just be a brochure site. Here's who I am. Here's what I do. Here's how to contact me. And if you can, try to get an easy-to-remember name so you could tell somebody, here's the name of my site, and they could actually remember it. Although that's not crucial, it helps. And you'll see I obviously have a very, very long name, and I have a reason for choosing that, primarily for search engine optimization. But it's good to have an easy-to-remember name. And also do search engine optimization on your site if you do that. And if you don't know much about that, just find somebody who does so that when editors do a Google search, you'll have a better chance of being on page one, page two of the rankings of the search engine results for what they're looking for. And finally, on the subject of websites, I suggest that you join LinkedIn. Many of you are likely already there, but I had a situation last week where an editor for one of the major publishers, and this is a company that I think I did one or two projects for them in the 1990s, but none since, he just wrote me an email out of the blue and said, oh, hey, I want to talk to you about some upcoming projects. Can we set a time to talk? So we talked for about a half an hour, had a great conversation, and the potential is there that there'll be multiple projects down the road, and who knows, maybe for years and years. And he said he found me through searching LinkedIn. And so I suggest you get on LinkedIn, you put in, you know, fill out your profile, do what you need to do there, even if you don't do much with LinkedIn. And I don't. I've done some connecting primarily with freelance writers and college textbook publishers and editors, some things like that, primarily around that professional side of my life, but I haven't paid a lot of attention to it, but it could wind up paying off big for me right here. We'll have to see about the specific case, but I was just surprised because I just haven't put much focus on LinkedIn. All right, let's move on to number 8, important characteristics of a successful supplements writer. There are 5 important characteristics that will help to make you as successful as possible. Number 1, very important, you have to do high quality work. And if you, that's just bottom line, you've got to do that. And how do you do high quality work? Well, follow whatever guidelines your editor gives you. They'll usually say, this is how we want this done. This is the number of questions, or this is how we want you to format, or whatever it is. They will tell you, this is how you do this. And then also, to make sure you do high-quality work, once you've started a project, complete a sample chapter and then send it to your editor for review and say, is this what you want? Am I following your guidelines? Is there any way that I could improve on this? You want to be clear on this. This has never really happened to me, But I know I've heard from talking to editors that it has happened with other projects where somebody will complete an entire supplement and then they turn it in. And then it turns out that there was something that they weren't doing correctly. And then they have to go back and add in material or reformat test questions or do something like that. You don't want that to happen to you. You also need to have good writing skills. You can learn to become a better writer. Most of you are probably decent enough writers to get going on this, but you want to have good writing skills, and you need to self-edit your work. I never assumed that any editor anywhere, whether it's outdoors publications, the books I write, anything, or textbook supplements, I never assume anybody's going to edit my work. And there are times they do and oftentimes make great suggestions, but when I send something off, I want to feel comfortable enough that this is really good. I like how it represents me. Okay, moving on with this list of important characteristics of a successful supplements writer. Number two, you need to meet or beat deadlines. Missing deadlines is bad, and in the, I don't know how many projects I've done by now, 240, 250. There's only been once or twice that I missed a deadline, and it was maybe only by a day or two, and there was a very, very good reason for it. And if you do have to meet, or if you are going to miss a deadline, let the editor know as soon as possible so you can discuss what to do about it. And I always try to beat deadlines whenever I can. That makes you look really good. And if you are going to beat a deadline, let the editor know, because oftentimes there's something that has to happen downstream from what you're doing where other people have to schedule things, and you getting something in 3 or 4 days early could really help them out. There could be some people that thought something else was coming in, there's downtime, and you can help. So always let them know if you're going to beat a deadline. Number three on our list, good marketing skills, and we basically discussed this up above on how you land an assignment. But you need to be good at connecting with editors, staying in contact with editors, and selling yourself to them. Number four, you need to have good communication skills. This means that you follow through on phone calls and emails, and that you just follow good practices for good, clear communication whenever you're on the phone or you're writing an email. And this also means timeliness, returning emails promptly, getting back to people quickly so everything flows smoothly. And then finally, number five, you need good time management skills. And this leads us into number nine on our list here, how to create high-quality supplements quickly. And there are seven things I want to discuss here that will help you to do this. Number one, learn how to speed read. And I can say something that has just been crucial for me over the last few years for increasing my income and just helping me to get lots of things done more quickly is I taught myself how to speed read. And this doesn't have to be a big deal. Most people read 300, maybe 350 words a minute. It's not hard with maybe 5 or 10 hours of practice and learning some basic skills that you would get in any book on speed reading to double that, to say 600 to 700 words a minute. And that's probably where I am. I'm probably somewhere 600 to 1,000 words a minute. I haven't tested myself in a long time. But you can't speed read everything, of course. It depends on what you're doing. But there's times you'll be looking at a textbook, you're creating a supplement, and you're looking for specific information, or you already know all this stuff, and you just need to know what is specifically in this section here so that you can write your question, or if you're writing a lecture outline, you go, yeah, okay, that's there. So you can whip right through it. So learn how to speed read. Number two, break work into manageable chunks. Sometimes you look and you say, oh, I have this whole chapter to do, and it's going to take me several hours. What I do is I work A-head to A-head in the book. And an A-head is the largest subdivision of a chapter. If a chapter is 20 pages long, it will usually have somewhere like 4 to 7 A-heads that are the basic subdivisions of the chapter. So you work A-head to A-head, you get to a good stopping point at the end if you need to do that. Number three, develop routines so that you always do the same thing in the same way. And this lets your brain get into a pattern of how to do this. And you'll find that it helps you to go really fast. For a long time, I did projects where I gave instructions on how to do art splits for science textbooks. And I had to enter all this information into a software program that I access remotely, and I had to fill out all these fields, and I had to rename a lot of file names and not mess them up, because this was all HTML and all these sorts of things, and one error would mean that it wouldn't be readable. And I always made sure I did all those fields in the exact same order so that my brain would not have to think, what am I doing, what am I doing? It's this field, that field, that field, that field on through. Okay, number four, be interested in the subject matter. And the more you are truly interested and fascinated by what you're doing, the more you're going to be into it, the more you're going to be focused, the less you're going to get distracted. So just be interested in what you're doing, and you'll find that it just flows really, really quickly. Number five, take care of your health. Of course, this is a broad subject, and you all probably know a lot about this, but make sure you get enough sleep. If you're sleepy, you're going to have a hard time doing this work quickly. It's going to just take you longer, period. Make sure you get adequate exercise, good diet, drink plenty of water, all those things that you know. But just think about that. The more alert you are and the better you feel, the more quickly you're going to get the work done. And this ties into number six, which is be mentally alert. This ties into making sure you get enough sleep. I am a person who drinks moderate amounts of coffee. I find it helps me to get work done in most instances, but I knock off by early afternoon, so it doesn't affect my sleep at night. But you need to be mentally alert to get this done quickly. And finally, number seven, minimize any distractions. Now, if you have a home office, if you have kids around, you need to tell them, hey, you know, mommy or daddy has to work for a couple hours, please leave me alone. If you can, have a home office someplace where you can close the door. But I find that I will frequently just turn the ringer off on the phone and try not to let yourself, you're working on your computer, it's probably connected to the internet. There's that tendency to think, oh, boy, this is, you know, I'm getting a little tired of doing this. I'll go check my email, or I'll go on Facebook, or whatever your favorite websites that you like to go look at. It's so easy to let yourself get distracted by that. So don't do that. If you have those automatic alert things that go ding or bong every time you get an email, turn them off. I've had those off for years. So we've gone through our nine main topics. I hope that you have found it useful. I really enjoyed sharing that with you. And I am now ready for your questions.
All right. If you want to ask a question, please press 4-star to unmute yourself. Any questions?
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, this is Elsa. I do have a question, John.
Hello, Elsa.
Hi. I'm sorry, but I just as you were talking about not having interruptions in the house,
I had
an interruption in the house when you were talking about how to create high-quality supplements quickly, and I missed your third and fourth points.
Okay. The third point is to develop routines so that you always do whatever you're doing in the same manner and in the same order, so that your mind gets used to this is how I do this, and it doesn't have to like reload all the operating procedures for doing something. It just goes, okay, yes, this, and it becomes a routine. So that's number three. And then number four is be interested in your subject matter. Be fascinated by it. So then you just really want to read it. You really want to do your work.
Great. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Does anyone else have any questions? You have to press 4-star to unmute yourself if you're trying to ask a question.
Well, while we're waiting, I'll throw out another one.
Okay.
You were saying to follow instructions, and I've been on both the freelance end and also on the client end of this, and I just can't emphasize too strongly, don't be afraid to ask if you don't understand something in the instructions.
Yes.
I once had an author who was supposed to work on a supplement, and he was supposed to write at least X number of questions per A head, and like 2 weeks later, I was checking with him, how's it going, and he finally confessed, well, I went all through the manuscript and I couldn't find anything called an A-head.
Yeah.
And I felt so bad for him because if he had just said, forgive me, but what's an A-head, it would have been really easy to tell him what it was.
Yeah, and that's something that you have to be willing. I just found in life that you have to be willing to ask questions, even though you might think this is a basic question. I should know this. I should understand this. But it's important. It's important to say it, to ask these questions. Yeah, I could see where that would be a problem.
Yeah. Another little story I'll share is that I had a colleague who worked only with supplements, and one day I was just very frustrated because I think I had three different supplements authors who all had some sort of reason why they couldn't turn in their material on time, and it was going to be maybe a two-week delay or something, and they hadn't let me know in advance. I said to her, I just need to vent for a minute, and then, so-and-so says that he's in the hospital and blah, blah, blah. And she looks at me and she says, I'm not saying that people don't go to the hospital, but if I had a $10 bonus for every time one of my supplements authors has given me that kind of a story, I could retire, you know? So, really, I mean, meeting or beating deadlines is so much the name of the game because it's all connected. There's a whole chain of events that depends on that particular date.
Yeah, I have found that, and I have really, really stressed that whenever I'm dealing with a new editor, I say, hey, I always meet my deadlines. I always meet them or I beat them, and I stress I've been doing this for 16 years. I let them know that I'm a professional, that I do this, and I'll get this done. And it's interesting you're saying supplements authors are like, oh, I had to go to the hospital. It reminds me of college students when they don't have their paper done on time. It's like, oh, you know, all those excuses we all have heard when we were either students or in the case of those of us who have taught, your students come in and say, oh, well, you know, this happened or that happened. And sometimes they're valid. Sometimes they are valid. But usually if somebody's 2 weeks late on a supplement, they knew they were going to be 2 weeks late quite a while back and they didn't get a hold of you.
Right.
All right, any other questions? I saw someone else had unmuted themselves.
I have a question.
Okay,
okay.
Hello. Go ahead.
Speaking of chain of events and the diligence to meet deadlines, a lot of these supplements depend on other work meeting deadlines. So how often, I'm just curious to know, have you been ready to go to work and it's late getting to you?
I will answer that. And Elsa, are you still on the line?
Yes, I am.
Okay, well, I'll answer it. And then you, if you wouldn't mind giving your answer from the other end, from the editor side of it also, it happens a lot, a lot, that they say, oh, it'll be ready on such and such a date, and then it's not. Now, in all fairness, they will usually say, we are hoping to start around early December.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times it will be ready early December, but then there's so many things that have to lead up to that. Authors have so much work they have to do, and sometimes I look and think, as the supplements writer, what I write, and then I look and I think, there's got to be 400,000 words in this textbook or something. Some of these things are just really so much information in there. So oftentimes it can get slowed down for many, many reasons, but it does happen. And that's why it's crucial as a supplements writer, you have to be flexible and you have to flex with the schedules. And if something happens, and it has happened to me a couple of times where a supplement would be delayed so much that I'd have to say, well, we have to move the deadline out. And they will usually be pretty good about that. They'll realize if they got it to you 2 weeks later, that you're going to get it to them a couple weeks later. But I try, even if they get it to me late, I'll still try to get it done within the original deadline if I can, because that can get them back on track by me taking up the slack. And then that helps down the road. The next time they need to hire somebody, they'll remember, oh, boy, John, he came through that one time when we were late, and he got it done really fast, and we got back on track. So Elsa, what do you think?
Oh, I totally agree. And, you know, that's why somebody like you, who is not actively teaching as a full-time professor, can still get these kinds of jobs. The publishing companies love to hire professors to write supplements because it's like seeding adoptions. If a certain professor has an investment connected with this textbook, then when the textbook comes out, that's going to be a good prospect to try to get an adoption from that professor. So why should they hire a freelancer? Well, the answer is because the freelancer is a hero. You know, it saves the day a few times, plus turns out really good stuff. Then they're like, okay, well, it's worth it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, and it's totally understandable if a professor has a semester schedule or a quarter schedule, and you know, midterms are going to be on this date. None of that is going to change. So if that professor planned on being able to write the supplement before midterms, and then the supplement is 2 weeks late and it comes right in the middle of midterms, the professor can't make changes to say, okay, I'll save the day for you. They can only work around their teaching commitments. So, the publisher has to be able to be a little bit flexible about that. But then in a case like that, if the professor is honest with them and says, you know, really, I could have done it 2 weeks ago, but now I'm not going to be able to get to it for another 2 weeks. What do you want to do? Then if the client says, well, maybe we better hire you for something else later down the line and go ahead and use a freelancer who can just dive in right away.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I've also had it happen to me many, many times where an editor emails me and says, hey, we have a rush project here. Can you get this done in 3 weeks or 2 weeks or something like that, a much shorter window? And to me, I think that there's two reasons why this likely happened. The most likely is they had somebody else in mind, but then that other person, for whatever reason, was not able to come through for them. So then they're suddenly scrambling. And then I also wonder sometimes with some editors if they just are so busy with so many things that they sometimes just forget, oh, yeah, I have to find somebody for that, those PowerPoint lectures or something like that.
Yep, that happens all the time. And the other thing that's just going through my mind as you're saying that is sometimes the relationship with a professor could fall apart because maybe they were planning on hiring a certain professor to do it, but in the meantime, that professor was already working on something else and, you know, came in late, tried to change the terms of the contract after the fact. You know, I've had that happen where somebody says, well, this ended up being so much work that I really think you should be paying me twice as much as what you said you were going to pay. And, well, you know, you can't do that. I mean, the budget is set. The budget is approved by somebody in the financial department at the publishing company, and the particular editor who has hired you can't just say, okay, well, instead of giving you $1,000, I'll give you $2,000. So, and that, you know, goes back to your thing about the pricing. But there are a lot of reasons why relationships could break down, and they could at the last minute decide that it's really not a good idea to rehire somebody that they were planning on.
Yeah. That makes sense, and that's why I always want to be really clear on what's the scope of the project that I'm doing. What is it exactly do you want me to do? And this is usually specified in the contract, but if it's not specified adequately, I at least want to make sure there's an email that says you need to do X number of questions or this or that, so that it's clear in case down the road. This has happened a few times where I'll be in the middle of the project, and then an editor will go, you know, we've also decided that now we want to add in these extra things too. We also want you to add this into every chapter, and there's not always a willingness or the ability to pay more money for that work. And you can address it and discuss it. And there's times if it's a small amount of work, I'll just do it. Or if it's a substantial amount of work, I'll say, well, I'd like some more compensation for this. And on a related matter, what I do sometimes is I will look at what are ways that I can add value to a project that don't take a lot of extra time for me, and then I will just do it. And I'll get an okay and say, hey, are you comfortable of instead of writing 5 short answer questions, I'd like to write 10. Because short answer questions are pretty easy to, you can write those pretty quickly. And if there's, it's not hard to come up for that, with them for that particular project, you might say, hey, I can add some value here without it really being much more work for me, but it will help make this a better test bank. And then another example, I'm doing a project right now for a nonprofit where I'm writing questions and creating an instructor's manual, and that's one of the big projects where they found me through a Google search. And I just volunteered. I said, hey, the manuscript that I'm working off, I'm seeing occasional errors in the writing. And what I did is I went to my main contact and just to her and said, how would you feel if I were to send you a Word document with a few editing changes and suggestions here? Would you be comfortable with that? Because you never know, there may be somebody who's hired to be a proofreader and they don't want somebody else pointing out things they missed or something. But I politely asked that and she said yes. So I just include that because I'm reading over that. And if I see an error just in my, as I'm going by, I have the document open with track changes on, I just go in and go boom and just fix it. And I email it and I'm not charging extra for that. It's maybe an extra 5 or 10 minutes for each chapter I work on, but they're paying me really, really well, and I'm comfortable doing that, and I think it helps, and it's going to help create a positive impression in their mind of me. Anybody else on the line with other questions?
Yeah, does anyone else have any other questions before we end our call today? Again, press 4-star to unmute yourself to ask a question.
Yeah, we've got a few more minutes.
We do, so. Sometimes takes a moment there. Someone just had unmuted themselves. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. Another question, if you wouldn't mind, and that is, I would assume there's quite a wide array of ancillaries that get created. What is the hardest to learn to do if you haven't done them before? What's the most challenging? And perhaps also, what would be an easy kind of ancillary for somebody to break in on?
For me, the hardest ancillaries are test banks, writing test questions, because it takes a lot of experience to write good test questions that are, number one, fair, and then number two, are easy for the student to understand. And I feel I'm pretty good at writing test questions, but it just takes a lot of mental brain power. For me, it's the highest level of brain power to sit down and write test questions for several hours. And it depends on the subject matter and what types of questions they want. It gets hardest when they want a whole bunch. Multiple choice questions are the most difficult ones to write. The others for me are fairly easy. To write an essay question or a true false for me is pretty easy. But multiple choice, especially if they want a lot of them, you may be thinking, oh, I have to write 5 multiple choice questions per page of text, and the first 2 or 3 might come easy, but then trying to come up with a fourth one and a fifth one, you can be racking your brain and write questions that are good questions. And then you also, depending on the project, but usually you have to write some of those questions that are testing analytical skills. Those can be those can be more difficult to write as far as writing a good question and a fair question. So I would say that for me, the test questions are the hardest. Easiest things, I think writing lecture outlines is pretty easy. At least it's easy for me. I really enjoy doing that. That's my favorite type of project because I just have the page proofs of the textbook in front of me, and sometimes if I'm lucky, the textbook's already printed, so I just have this big, beautiful textbook, and I'm just going through and creating a really good PowerPoint for professors to use in the classroom. But that's where you're just like, oh, what's the most important material here? How can I write it in a way that would be the easiest for students to understand, for profs to lecture from, and how do I pick the right amount of material so I'm not giving them just like laying all the facts out there. Students still need to take notes, but it's the most fun and the easiest thing to do. And I think that would be a good way to get started if you're trying to break in. And I wouldn't shy away from a test bank. I would just want to know what is the scope of it and is it something that you feel comfortable that you can do it. I broke in with test banks, and for the most part, when I first started out, I was writing a lot of test questions. And then over time, the last 3 or 4 years, I'm still writing some test questions, but it's shifted to other areas.
Am I still unmuted? This is Elsa.
Oh, okay.
Yes, you are. We can hear you.
I am? Okay. I was going to say about the one thing about test banks that I've sometimes neglected to explain to people is that if it's a test bank, it's okay to have questions be somewhat repetitive, to be asking the same question in different ways, because no one professor is going to use every single question that's in there, or they shouldn't anyway. So it's okay to be somewhat repetitive, but at the same time, you're probably given some sort of guideline, like you want X percentage of application questions where it would be a story, like, you know, Bob went to the store and so-and-so happened and how does this apply to so-and-so concept, and then have your multiple choice versus just simply this concept means and give your multiple choices. Another thing is that a lot of the software doesn't like to go with none of the above or all of the above because it randomizes, so the other answer choices aren't necessarily above.
Yes, and that's I found over the last few years that editors are saying, we don't want you to use none or all. If you do use these, you can say none of these or all of these to deal with the randomization.
Right.
But I have found, because many of the times I've dealt with a test bank, I've been updating an older version of a test bank, and almost everybody does not use all of these and none of these correctly. So I would say it's best for people to just not do it, because if you're going to do it, if there's five possible answers, if you use all of these, it can only be the correct answer 20% of the time. Otherwise, you're just telegraphing. And it's the same with none of these. If students start getting used to, oh, well, almost all the time when all of these is an option, it is the correct option, you're not really, it's not a good test item.
How to Be a Freelance Writer for College Textbook Publishers is an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.